Hello, and welcome to Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 16 for September 15th, 2009. My name is Ben Snickoff, and I'll be your host today. With me today, we've got
Dominic Rabier
and David O'Brien.
We have three, as usual, three great stories for you this week. First off, the Twitter changes to their terms of service. Secondarily, we've got a story about statutory damages and the first real challenge, real due process challenge that we've seen to statutory damages. And finally, we've got a story about Glenn Beck and online defamation. So to dive right into it, this week, Twitter, particularly Biz Stone, sent an email to all Twitter users saying that he had changed the terms of service for Twitter. And this has gotten some press. So, Dave, can you give us a brief rundown of what the difference is between the old terms of service and the new terms of service are?
Sure. They actually changed almost everything, including the entire, or at least the entire formatting of the way that the terms of service show up when you click on the link. Some of the most significant changes, though, that I think have drawn the most controversy this week have to do with content ownership. So do you actually own or own a copyright to your tweets as you submit them through the website? The new terms of service essentially say that, well, yes, you do own the copyright to your tweets, but they also require you to give a full license to Twitter and allow them to, I'm going to read right out of their terms of service here, to copy, reproduce, process, adapt, modify, publish, transmit, display, and distribute any of your tweets, basically in any form that they see fit. And that's what has drawn the most controversy this week, I think.
Yeah, the post title on Slashdot about this was Twitter says your tweets belong to you, but you know, while I would still retain a copyright in any, of course, copyrightable tweets that I have, it's kind of a Pyrrhic ownership if Twitter has the right to modify my tweets. It doesn't strike me as much ownership if Twitter can change them without consulting me.
Now, the old terms of service actually said, we claim no intellectual property rights over the material you provide to the Twitter service. Your profile and materials uploaded remain yours. You can remove your profile at any time by deleting your account. This will also remove any text and images you have stored in the system. But the new terms of service are entirely different in the sense that they say, well, yeah, sure, you own the copyrights to your things, but you're also licensing them to us at the same time. So the interesting thing that strikes me about that is they have required you to license all of the exclusive rights that you might have gotten under copyright law, assuming that a tweet that you submitted is copyrightable, which in most circumstances they probably are. But you're licensing all those rights right away. So although you still retain the copyright overall, you've just given Twitter all those rights to do whatever they want under the Copyright Act.
Yeah, I want to say that's not quite true. It doesn't seem to be that Twitter has reserved the right of public performance of your tweets. So it doesn't seem like that they can stand out and for commercial profit read your tweets to people. But other than that, it seems like they have gotten most of the right.
Well, maybe they can't read them in the way that performance is
that
defined under the Copyright Act.
That was supposed to be a joke.
Oh, okay. Okay. I was going to say, because, you know, they can still take your tweets, repost them anywhere else, and reproduce them in another form. And they can also modify them, too, based on the way this is written, because they have this word adapt in there. And I think what this gets at is that Twitter is looking for a way to monetize their service. And even in Bistone's email, which went out to everybody, I myself got one, just like all of you did, he mentioned in there that, and is also, I think, mentioned in the terms here, that in the future they're considering including some form of advertising. And I think what that might be trying to get at is that there's going to be, or there might possibly be, some sort of insertion of advertisements into your tweets.
Right.
That would be really annoying.
Yeah,
it sure would.
I mean, I certainly agree that Twitter has that capability, and the terms of service can be read to include that. But my feeling is that while they legally could do it with these terms of service, they probably wouldn't, just because it would make people leave Twitter so quickly.
Well, so under the terms of services they've written in here, I think that Twitter is covering its own legal bases in addition to yours. So if they were to already come up before, say, let's say that this new terms of service did come out. If Twitter was to come up with some new way of inserting advertisements into tweets, and they started adapting or modifying your tweets and inserting ads into them, conceivably, under the old terms of service, you could sue them for some form of copyright infringement because they are modifying and reproducing or, you know, essentially preparing derivative works of your copyrighted tweets. Now, under this new terms of service, this is just giving them a legal vehicle to completely insert whatever they like into tweets. And it might not be as evil as it sounds, but the problem is it's very broadly written, so it's just giving them full license to do whatever they want, and I think that's the most concerning thing about it.
You're right. It seems like our tweets were much more our own tweets back under the old terms of service than they are under the new terms of service.
The other disturbing thing about this that I wonder about is the way that this is written. It almost seems like if you're submitting content in the form of links, so for instance, if you write a blog post and then you tweet it and include a link, it's at least possible under one reading of the terms of service, you might be licensing that work too on your blog in addition to the tweet. It's a little unclear, though, if that's actually what they were trying to do here.
Could you stretch that out a little bit? Because I think that's it's a stretch of the reading, and I'd like to hear really where you're picking that up from.
Right. So it sort of depends on two different parts of the terms here. They, at the top, as in any standard form contract, you have these term recitals. And terms in a contract, everybody has probably seen them at some point in their lives. They're capitalized things. And if you read at the very top of the terms of service, it, you know, defines things. These terms of service, and then in quotations, terms, you know, here and after they're going to be referred to as terms with a uppercase T, govern your access to and use of the services in Twitter's websites, the services, and another capitalized term there. And then it goes on to say, and any information, text, graphics, or other materials uploaded, downloaded, or appearing on the services, collectively referred to as the content. And then throughout the rest of the terms of service agreement, you see, of course, these three defined terms reused, and with their capitalized first letters. And as you get down to the section about your rights, it says you retain rights to any content, again, that defined term, you submit, post, or display through the services. But it also is granting this license, which in the exact wording here says, you agree that this license includes the right for Twitter to make such content available to other companies, organizations, individuals, and a bunch of other things. And it includes also the wording of the license. And it allows them to copy, reproduce, adapt, modify, publish, and transmit. So if you take a really broad meaning of what content could mean, it's very broadly defined. If we go back to it, it says here, any information, text, graphics, or other materials uploaded, downloaded, or appearing on the services. That's an incredibly broad sentence. And I think what you can get at through this is if you're submitting links to content that you own, perhaps on another website like a blog, you would have a copyright in any expression that you've written on your own blog. It's at least possible you've just licensed them the same exact rights to that blog that you've also licensed in the form of your individual tweet.
Wait, I don't follow that. How would you license your blog by tweeting?
I think, well, Dave's argument is that, I'm going to jump in for a second, is that
sure.
The other information uploaded, or maybe it's, I don't know. So,
oh, other materials uploaded?
Yeah, it could
I
be
think
any
that's
of those
way
things.
Too. I don't know. I don't agree with that rating. I think that's way too broad of a rating. I think that's.
I agree with Dominic. The only information you're uploading onto their services, which is Twitter's website, is the link to the blog. So I think they're freely, you know, they can freely modify that tweet. They can freely, what else could they do? They could adapt it. They could republish it. They could do all of those things that they have to that. To that tweet, to even the link in that tweet, but I don't think that they could get to your blog through this.
In all practicality, I agree with you guys, but I think that the problem lies in how broad the statement is, because those little things, any information or any other materials uploaded, is just simply not defined. And if some circumstance arose where there was a lawsuit involving Twitter and somebody else, it's at least partially conceivable that Twitter could advance the argument that those broad terms that you've effectively agreed to by using their services could include licensing material that you've submitted through a link. I don't really think that that's very likely to come up, but it's just possible that it could.
I would hope that any court seeing such an argument would just not even laugh it out of court, because it is a point of concern in that that's a very broad term that isn't defined, and you can probably argue anything into that term. I don't think they would be successful in arguing anything into that term, or at least I hope they wouldn't be. But the term nonetheless remains as broad as it is. My question is, so this pertains to Twitter, but what about like third-party services that reuse Twitter's information or collect tweets or do stuff like that? Does the license to Twitter extend to those parties? Or say that I tweet something and my license goes to Twitter, and then some third-party Twitter indexing site, let's say, stores that tweet, and then let's say I delete it from Twitter, which would theoretically remove Twitter's right, but the third-party site doesn't know I deleted it from Twitter and thus keeps it in an archive. What happens then?
That's a good question. I don't think that these terms are applying to third parties in the way that you're suggesting, but because the license is clearly between yourself as the user of the Twitter services and Twitter itself, not between any third party. So the license rights are actually only going to Twitter, as I'm reading this.
Right. They do have rules for their API, but they're not very extensive, and it's not clear exactly, you know, what limitations it would put on that copying. So I mean, there's also a question with that, with those APIs, if you know you're enabling them to freely copy your tweets. There's an interesting service that popped up a while ago. I can't remember the name of it right now. I'll see if I can track it down in a second. Which would print tweets onto a T-shirt and ship them to you. It was something like $20. And what they would do is they'd keep $19 of it, and they'd send $1 back to the person who published the tweet. The problem was that the first iteration wasn't. It was an opt-out, and very few people knew about it. So they switched it to an opt-in, so that if people wanted to print tweets with your tweet on it, you'd have to first give them permission to do it, as opposed to the old way where they'd assume that you gave them permission.
You know, there's one thing that I think my hat will go off to Twitter for, and that's the way that they've written the terms of service are readable from a layperson's perspective. A lot of times on other websites, you see heavy legal jargon written in their terms of service agreements. They're written like more traditional legal contracts. There's benefits, I think, to doing that, and that one of them is that you have highly defined terms, and they're very specific usually for what the terms actually are on a legal level, but it doesn't make them very readable to lay people. This here is written sort of a little bit more casually, and you could read through it and sort of understand exactly what's going on, and it enables you to, you know, do your own research, I guess, and you know, determine if this is a service that you actually want to use. Also interesting was the fact that BizStone emailed everybody about this, about the change in the terms of service, because under the old agreement, they had a clause in there which said they can modify, and almost every site that has a terms of service agreement has something similar to this, but they had a term that said that they could modify the terms of service at any time, really not subject to any notice.
Those are always questionable as far as how binding they are, just because it's hard to properly enact a new contract without informing people that it changed or informing people of what those changes are.
Right, and that's my guess as to why we actually got an email like that, is because the terms had changed so drastically that Twitter wanted to make sure you were aware that the terms were changing in this manner.
Yeah, fair argument. Any concluding thoughts from either of you two?
No, not really. I mean, I think that this is a pretty standard change in the terms of services, and although some of these portions of the terms of service are very broadly written, I don't necessarily think that they might be as evil as some people suggest, but time will tell, and we'll see how Twitter changes its model and what exactly they're going to do with this new advertising scheme that they've come up with. And we'll just have to leave it until then.
Dominic?
that's pretty much it. I'm not sure what they've announced with regard to this scheme. I guess it's this terms of service sort of paves the way for any potential changes. So
okay. We're
waiting and seeing.
So our next story is that a court in the Northern District of California recently rejected what's called a due process challenge to a statutory damage award. And this was a cyber squatting case. So to give you a little reference, currently several people are challenging the award of what are called statutory damages in the file sharing case with Jamie Thomas and Joel Tenenbaum. What statutory damages are, as opposed to damages in, say, a tort case, like a slip and fall where you get money for the injuries that were caused to you and pain and suffering, and sometimes what are called punitive damages. In statutory damages case, the amount of damages that you can get, you know, what you can get from the defendant in the case, is instead defined by the statute. It's defined by the legislature or Congress in this case, and usually it's a range from $750 to $90,000 or something like that. So in the case that we have here, a company called Online NIC, or Online NIC, was what's commonly referred to as a cyber squatter. They registered a slew of domain names, all of which included the Verizon trademark, and they would put up on their websites, usually ads, with the hopes that somebody would, you know, mistype Verizon or do a Google search and get directed to one of these sites, or you know, type in like buyverizonphones.com and get directed to one of these sites, click on their ads and make some money. Verizon filed suit over these domain names, and there were a handful of these domain names. Does anybody remember off the top of your head how many there were?
Hundreds, I want to say.
Yeah, there were a lot. Anyway, Verizon filed suit. Online NIC didn't respond, and what's called the default judgment was entered against them. They then eventually responded once the judge entered a default judgment, which is what happens when you don't show up for a trial.
Sorry, it was 663 domain names.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot of domain names. So the judge entered a default judgment and awarded Verizon damages of $31.5 million. That's $50,000 per confusingly similar domain name. And eventually what happened was Online NIC responded, said, hey, that was a lot of money. We're not cool with us owing that much money, and tried to challenge this. Unfortunately, they were a little late in the game, and they also did not have a very good case to make. And the judgment stood. So the core of this issue is that they challenged on due process grounds. They were saying that they challenged a statutory damage award on due process grounds. They were saying that the award of $50,000 to Verizon per domain name that was registered, all 600, and you said 636?
663 at least.
663 at least. Because I mean, that's a lot of domain names, but Online NIC's argument was that, you know, $31 million is so absurdly disproportionate to the amount of harm that we actually caused that it should be thrown out because it violates, you know, certain fundamental rights of damages being proportional or at least reasonably related to the harm that was caused. Unfortunately, the judge did not agree with that and kind of tossed that argument out.
Well, yeah, first, Online NIC was contending that they had only derived $1,468 worth of profit from the use of those 663 domain names.
Right, but that's really a poor analysis of damages regardless. So in any case, the amount of damages shouldn't be how much the defendant made off of you. I mean, there are a few cases where that is. In patent cases, that's sometimes, you know, what their profit was. But usually, I mean, even then, that's usually not the measure of damages. The measure of damages is how much harm it caused to the plaintiff, not how much profit it brought to the defendant. You know, if I slip and fall on your sidewalk, we don't ask how much you saved by not fixing your sidewalk and then giving me that amount of money. We give me the amount of money to fix my leg and to convince you that you shouldn't have done that.
But isn't it often that the problem is that it's really difficult to determine what damages have occurred in a cyber squatting case like this?
Right. It's nearly impossible to determine.
Right.
So that's why they have statutory damages. It's to make that determination easier. It serves two purposes. First, it does make that the damages calculation easier. You're not going to be hearing a lot of evidence as to how much damage actually occurred. You know, how much business was redirected from Verizon, how much it hurt Verizon's trademarks, how much it hurt their image online. You're just going to be hearing argument as to what the appropriate measure of damages would be, you know, somewhere between those two statutory limits. The other thing that it does is it serves a disincentive. It tries to convince people not to do this because of, you know, what the high cost is should they get caught.
Makes sense. So what sort of, like, did they, so they basically didn't respond, and they said that it wasn't constitutional because they didn't respond, correct?
So one of the arguments was that they should have had a jury to determine what the statutory damages were, and the judge disagreed with that. For starters, while there would be a jury if this were a Copyright Act, there were two problems with this. First, this falls under a different act called the Anti-Cyber-Squatting and Consumer Protection Act, and no one's determined whether or not there's a jury trial, a right to a jury trial to determine damages under that act. And the second problem was that usually an entry of default waives your right to a jury trial. The theory there being, if you don't show up the first time, we're going to try to get this through our court as quickly as possible on the second time.
So because guys, go ahead, Dave.
I'm sorry, this is a little bit off point, but can you guys shed a little light on what the domains that Online Nick had registered look like?
MobileVerizon.net, MyPrepaidVerizon.com, Verizon-Cell-Phones.com, VerizonCellularPhone.com.
So we're talking about a series of domains, basically, that use the Verizon trademark.
Yeah,
correct.
Seems like
and all
of them
sort
do.
Of pretend to be official Verizon sites.
VerizonOnline.com, VerizonCareers.com, VerizonLGPhones.com, VerizonOnePhone.com, VerizonPhoneServices.com, VerizonPay.com, VerizonWireless.com. Those were actually all domain names that were domain names. What did you call it? Domain name tasting?
Domain name tasting, yeah, or perhaps the opinion calls it kiting. Basically, it's registering and re-registering a domain name because ICANN, the organization that's in charge of domain names, they have set out rules that if you say I register a domain name and I want to register Dominic.net, but I tragically typo during my own name, and then I realize, oh no, I actually registered Dominic.net because I forgot to type an A in, or an I in my name. So then I can say, oh, I'm sorry, I registered the wrong one. I can let me undo that registration and not pay any fees. So the way that these guys abused it is they would register and then say, oh, we actually misregistered, and then within 5 days unregister, and then say, oh, time to re-register, and then kept doing that over and over again, domain tasting. That way, it's never officially viewed as registered, so it doesn't appear in some records where trademark owners will look. But at the same time, it does come up and does work, which means that they're basically getting to free ride off of Verizon's name without having to pay any fees.
Yes, and the way that they repeatedly did this, it looks like, at least in the opinion, they have 6 or 7 sham corporations listed. That would
right.
One of them would, you know, do a domain testing, then the next one would do a domain name testing, then the next one would do a domain name testing.
From the evil mastermind perspective, that makes sense because you'd be the same person over and over again registering because people would get suspicious. But if it's different companies, then it looks more legit, I guess.
Yeah, my guess is the judge is calling this kiting because it's like flying it up there for a test.
Sure.
But that's not a term that I had heard before we read this opinion. I'm sorry, Dominic.
No,
okay, so another thing that the judge was considering in whether or not the damages were inappropriate were the amount of essentially fraudulent activity that the defendant allegedly did, such as repeatedly, you know, doing this domain name testing with all those different shell corporations, was one of the things he considered. There was also some misconduct at trial that the judge mentioned that led to sanctions, in fact, on the part of the trial counsel. So there were a lot of things here that were not good facts that led to the determination that that the statutory damages here were appropriate.
So they get, I guess they sort of tried to advance an argument using some constitutional cases with regard to punitive damages, right?
Right, they did. So the general argument, so at least the Supreme Court's rule of thumb is that if you've got a case that's not being determined under statutory damages, the maximum punitive damages that you can get are somewhere between 1 and 10 times the amount of actual damages. So let's say we're in that I'm on that sidewalk, and your sidewalk is, you know, it's covered in ice, absolutely super super thick. I slip and fall and I break my arm. It costs $100 to fix my arm, and my pain and suffering was worth $300. So that's a total of $500 I get in what's called compensatory damages. In addition, if the jury finds that your action was willful or wanton or reckless, they can tack on punitive damages as, you know, an extra kicker to say, you know, we're going to discourage you from not taking care of your sidewalk anymore.
And they might want to do this, for example, if there's evidence that you were informed that this is very dangerous and there were letters and people were protesting outside and you didn't do anything or something.
Right, or if your conduct was absolutely absurd, like letting somebody who had a history of being an alcoholic pilot an oil tanker off the coast of Alaska. So what the jury would do is tack on what we call these punitive damages, and the Supreme Court has said that proper punitive damages would be between, in that case that I listed before, $400 and $4,000. And anything more than that would be considered, at least on its face, to be way too much. It would be considered excessive, and it would be reviewed as, you know, too much. And it would probably be overturned unless there was a good reason for it.
And they tried to use this argument with regard to statutory damages, which
yes.
aren't exactly the same as punitive damages.
Right, they are not.
They're very different.
Yes, and the judge found here that the test that the judge actually used is whether or not they bore any reasonable relation to the damages caused in this case. And the judge said, you know, based on that, we're going to say that, yes, there is. Based on, you know, the extent of misconduct based that Online Nick did, based on all of the, you know, tricky things they did to try to avoid having this come up, based on their misconduct at trial, based on all of these things, yes, that damage has a reasonable relation to, you know, the award of damages in this case, the $31 million has a reasonable relation to what they actually caused in damages, and let it stand that way. And I guess that's one of the things that separates this from the file-sharing cases, or at least we can argue separates it from the file-sharing cases. In the file-sharing cases, we're talking about, you know, actual damage. I mean, actual damages are hard to determine from the standpoint of the record industries. Yes, there's that one, you know, the 99 cents that for each song that they took, but we don't know, you know, exactly how far it was distributed and how many people they ceded it to, but you also have to wonder if that matters. I mean, if Joel Tenenbaum wasn't ceding that file to somebody else was going to be ceding that file to somebody else.
So an interesting point here, I guess, is that we're looking at statutory damages for a trademark dispute, and that same analysis can still apply to copyright law and the statutory damages under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Right. There are similarities in these cases and there are differences. You know, the main difference is that they're different statutes. One's the Copyright Act, one's this Anti-Cyber Squatting and Consumer Protection Act. Another big difference is that in this case it was a commercial company who was exploiting these trademarks and these domain names for commercial gain. And in the Tenenbaum and Jamie Thomas cases, it was a private individual who was, you know, copying files for their own personal use.
So are they still using the same cases, though, that might apply in a similar argument against the statutory damages in copyright law?
Yes, they are.
It's the Gore and Campbell cases, I believe.
Yeah, those are the main cases on damages not being on excessive damages violating due process.
So what does this mean then for those challenges? And we're seeing some of those, I think they're in the pipeline pending for both of those two cases you mentioned, the Thomas case and the Tenenbaum case. What does this decision then have any effect on how a court might view those challenges based on that case law?
It's hard to tell. It's really hard to say. I mean, this case is so factually different from those other cases that it's hard to take a look at it and know exactly one way or the other. But this is the first court that we've seen consider this due process argument against statutory damages and point out that no court has ever rejected a statutory damage award for due process grounds. You know, point that out for the first point. And it's the first time we've seen a court outright reject that argument. But again, there are a lot of differences here. So the argument isn't dead, but it's not healthy.
So the underlying facts in the case still play a big role in evaluating the constitutionality, though, of a statutory damages provision.
Yes.
Of course. I guess one would hope they would, right?
Yeah. Any last thoughts on this before we move on to our last story? Dominic?
Nope.
David?
Nope.
Okay. So this next story is an interesting one, and I'm wondering if we should really say the domain name on this podcast. But Glenn Beck recently sued a website for... was there actually a suit filed, or is he just threatened to sue, now that I think about this?
No, there's a series of legal notices that have gone back and forth between the domain registrant company and the actual anonymous person who has registered this particular domain.
Okay, but no suit has been filed yet.
No suit,
okay.
As far as I know.
So... Oh, dear. The website URL is www.glennbeckrapedandmurderedayounggirlin1990.com. 1990 is numbers, not spelled out, just in case you were wondering. So, essentially, the argument here is this website and its associated content is defaming Glenn Beck, and I can't imagine why anyone would think that that's defamatory, but that seems to be the argument going on. So the wrinkle here, though, is that Glenn Beck is what's known as a birther. He has been making a series of allegations on television and in his column over the past few months now that go along the lines of this. I'm not saying that Barack Obama wasn't born in the United States, but I'm saying that a lot of people are asking this and that Barack Obama hasn't come out and denied these allegations. And you have to wonder, why isn't he denying these allegations? And to quote off of the website, quote, "Why won't Glenn Beck deny these allegations? We're not accusing Glenn Beck of raping and murdering young girls in 1990. In fact, we think he didn't. But we can't help but wonder, you know, since he has failed to deny these horrible allegations, why won't he deny that he raped and killed a young girl in 1990? So I guess the question that this raises is, yes, ordinarily a website with the URL www.glennbeckrapedandmurderedayounggirlin1990.com would be defamatory. Is the you know, parody-esque and commentary nature of this, does that in any way, you know, cut against the defamation?
It can. This is a complicated case, though, because the domain name itself... it seems to be very factual. But if you go to the site has a number of provisions on it which absolutely suggest that this is some form of parody or maybe even satire. And the problem, though, is that the way a court uses the metric that a court uses to evaluate this is they ask whether a reasonable reader might understand in the whole context of the defamation, whether this was a joke or not, whether it was a parody. And I think it's hard to say because, first of all, you have two separate issues here. You have the URL itself, and then you have the site. And when you go to the site, actually at the top, they've changed it, I think, since this controversy arose. And the banner on the site actually reads, "Did Glenn Beck rape and murder a young girl in 1990.com? And the URL, though, without that word "did" in front, still completely redirects to the site. And I think it's difficult to say, though, under that mythical reasonable reader standard, whether that reasonable reader might be able to determine immediately or throughout the course of reading the entire website whether or not this was a joke. And then you have the separate controversy of, well, the URL itself, as it appears, might be enough on its own just to be defamatory. But the standard that has been used in the years is that the court is going to look to the entire context of the defamation, and it's just a little unclear if they're going to only use the URL or if they're going to use the URL on the website. And even if they do that, whether or not this mythical reasonable reader is going to be would be able to determine that this is a parody.
Right. To read the to get the actual notice that this is a parody, you have to go all the way down to the bottom of the page, and it says, "Notice this site is a parody stroke slatire. We assume Glenn Beck did not rape and murder a young girl in 1990, although we haven't seen proof that he didn't. But we think Glenn Beck definitely uses tactics like this to spread lies and misinformation." That being said, it's reasonably determinable that it's a parody without actually reading that notice. I mean, for one, if you're familiar with what he says, it's fairly simple. Currently, the first thing on the page is a spoof on the Britney Spears boy, the Leave Britney Alone. So that would lead one to believe that this is also a parody. And on this side, it says things like meme origin and concept origin, and there's a whole bunch of fake evidence that's listed on the side of the page, too.
The problem with that, though, is that you're relying on an assumption that a person is familiar with those other things and even the word meme by itself, and that based on reading those in the context of the website, they'd be able to determine that it's a parody. I don't know how that might factor into the court's analysis, but it's one of those murky areas where you sort of don't know what the judge might say as it comes before him.
Yeah. Right.
URL... Do you guys remember the PETA case, PETA.org, when long, long ago in the early days of internet, someone registered people for the eating of tasty animals as PETA.org, and yes. The URL itself looked official, PETA.org, but the site itself was clearly a parody. Whereas here we have, I guess I'm trying to draw the analogy, where here we have the URL itself looks defamatory, because it doesn't have that did, it just says he raped and murdered a young girl in 1990. But the site itself is clearly a parody. Might a judge say, basically looking at the PETA case, that just because the URL is so, it doesn't have that did, I mean, it is so making a statement in terms of, might they consider the site itself defamatory?
I can't remember all the details of that particular case, but was that more a case of a trademark dispute than it was a defamation dispute?
Yeah. That's true. That was a trademark dispute.
That's interesting, though, because in this case, Glenn Beck, first of all, is a registered trademark. You can look it up on the test system on the USPTO. And they're also, I think, in the legal notices that have been sent back and forth to the both the domain registrant company and apparently the owner, too, they've suggested that they're going to file a UDRP claim based on trademark.
UDRP is Uniform Domain Name Resolution Protocol. It's a set of protocols set down by, I believe, ICANN solving domain name. It's WIPO in combination with ICANN, I think. I don't know.
Okay.
In any case, it's a set of protocols for resolving domain name disputes without going to court, because going to court is expensive, time-consuming, and basically painful for something as minor as a domain name sometimes. So just to fill that in. But yeah, so he filed a URP request, or he said he would file one?
But he's threatened at this point. Nothing has been filed. In any event, though, I think that's another uphill argument to make, because those claims require that there has to be a showing of bad faith on the part of the registrant, and based on the URL alone, and actually in conjunction with the context of the website itself, it's pretty clear that the purpose is potentially, or at least I shouldn't say it's pretty clear, but there's an argument that the purpose of the URL, or I'm sorry, the domain, is for critical commentary, and it's not some sort of bad faith attempt to usurp the commercial activities of the original trademark owner, who would be Glenn Beck.
Right, or profit off of his name. I'll note, very importantly, that there do not seem to be any ads on this site, which, if you ever wish to set up a criticism or a commentary site, don't put any ads on your site under any circumstances. Because judges love to latch onto that as proof that you want to capitalize financially off of the domain name as opposed to setting up an actual commentary site.
Yeah, so to get back to UDRP really quick, and we can tie this portion of this off really fast, UDRP was essentially developed to prevent people from registering identical or confusingly similar domain names to a trademark. And so that's more like the Verizon case that we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, as a matter of fact, the purpose of it is to try to prevent people from, you know, squatting and holding a domain and then trying to sell it, offer it back to the original trademark owner for money, things along those lines. That's all those things can sort of fall into a bad faith intent when you're registering a domain. So I think, though, that that's one of the more attenuated arguments here, if such a claim should be filed in this case for that.
Right, and to tie those two things together just a little more, the Anti-Cyber-Squatting and Consumer Protection Act is actually pretty much the federal counterpart to the UDRP that we were talking about. If you bring the UDRP and it fails, I don't know how it was fail. I don't think I've ever heard of a UDRP claim failing. But if that failed, you could still go to federal court. And it's a slightly more expensive system, but you know there are also greater rewards. With the UDRP, you would only get control of the domain name. And as we saw under the ACPA, you would get not only the domain name, but you could also get money damages for the commercial use of the domain name.
So, in other words, if you're a trademark owner and you're looking at a potential ACPA or a UDRP case, you essentially have a choice on which one that you want to pursue the person under for registering the domain.
And just as a quick note, UDRP claims can fail because I actually once worked on helping someone with UDRP arbitration resolution, I guess. The resolution. Just reading all about the case, and we, I think, ended up finding against the person who brought the claim just because some of the stuff that they had said wasn't necessarily true, and they basically... So sometimes people bring UDRP claims even though they don't win them.
I think when you do those, you have to certify that you are, in fact, the owner of the underlying trademark, and there's a bunch of other things that you're, you know, basically signing some sort of legal oath to under the, you know, pains and penalties of perjury and something along those lines, and you have to meet all those requirements for a valid claim. But getting back to the defamation portion of this story, which I think is the more interesting one, The other thing that we have to think about here is the New York Times v. Sullivan standard, which would apply in this case since Glenn Beck is unarguably a public figure. And what that means is it requires that a plaintiff like Glenn Beck to establish that there was malice in the case, it was malicious. The defamation was malicious. It wasn't just...
Yeah, so the standard is... And I'm using air quotes here, actual malice, but that extends to reckless and willful. It's a recklessness, right, Dominic?
Yes.
Yeah. So malice is loosely defined as just really sucking at fact checking, and I think you've got a tough claim if you're actually going to reach the question of actual malice. That standard, I think you've got a uphill battle on the part of the alleged defamers to say that they did not violate the actual malice standard by asserting that Glenn Beck raped and murdered a young girl in 1990.
I'm going to disagree because I think that this is much harder. And if you can establish that this site is absolutely a parody, then I think that alone is almost enough to make to sort of defeat a argument that there was some sort of actual malice or recklessness in using that particular URL in the context of the entire site. But again, that relies on this finding of whether or not this is a parody, and it goes back to the standard that the court uses, which is just terribly unclear, I think, in this case.
Okay. Sounds good. Any concluding thoughts, Dominic?
I guess we'll see what happens with regard to this suit in particular, but I imagine that the site will eventually be taken down because the joke will have run its course and it won't be in the interests of the people who have the site to maintain it and keep fighting.
Yeah, David?
Well, I have a couple extra thoughts, actually. First, it was sort of interesting, I read a few articles about this, that the Glenn Beck's attorneys had first, because this is the site is registered anonymously with a some of the privacy protection you can get when you register a domain name. You basically get this choice of whether or not you provide your actual information on a Whois lookup or whether or not you have some sort of company that you have to go through before you can find out who actually owns this particular domain. This guy, who is at this point remained anonymous, had that protection, and so the Glenn Beck's attorneys first had to send legal notices to that company. And I guess what had happened was that that company had either forwarded on the notices to the domain registrant, or they had communicated with him in some way saying, like, look, you've got some sort of legal problem that's going on here with your domain. And he had posted somewhere on the website, although I think it might have been removed now, that there, oh, actually, here it is. It says here in big bold letters somewhere in the middle of the site, if this site goes down, my web host is taking some flack over this website, so if he shuts down, it may take a bit to be get rehosted. Please bear with me if that happens. And then it sort of goes on to say a couple other things. But the following day that that post went up on the website, the Glenn Beck's attorneys were paying attention to that, and then they sent more notices to the domain registrant, according to this article I read, and basically saying, we know that you are in contact with the anonymous person, and they're essentially seeking to un-anonymize him, and they would love to get his name, I'm sure, to attach him to a lawsuit, or if they so choose to file.
Okay. Great points, one and all. Speaking of domain names, though, if you'd like to visit us, please head over to www.technicallylegal.org. If you have comments or concerns, questions, requests, please send them to podcast@technicallylegal.org. So closing out for tonight, my name is Ben Snakehoff, and with me...
I'm Dominic Ramier.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thanks for listening.